Welcome to the Theology on Tap Chattanooga podcast. In each episode, we feature a different lecture given by a writer, scholar, or public intellectual. Each of these talks explores the intersection between theology and culture, and how theology can help better guide us toward the common good of society. These talks are given live at our monthly Theology on Tap events at the Camp House in Chattanooga, Tennessee. For more information and to find out when our next live event is, check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheologyOnTapChattanooga. Now, here is this week's episode. We hope you enjoy listening.
Hey friends, Matt Busby here, host of Theology on Tap Chattanooga. For some reason, when we recorded this evening, we did not record the introduction of the speaker, and I really want to set up the context for that. And the recording actually kicks in just a few words into his lecture. It doesn't actually miss anything. But again, I want to be able to set up this evening because this is the first of a two-part series exploring trauma in the church. And so our first lecture was with Dr. Sam Youngs on March 15th, When Doctrine Hurts, Theology in Light of Trauma. And then the second part of this is going to be with Dr. Preston Hill on March 29th, In Search of Healing, Trauma in Light of Theology. And so this first talk is with Dr. Sam Youngs. Dr. Young serves as an associate professor of Christian studies at Bryan College. He's an adjunct professor of theology and church history at Richmond Graduate University and the dean of the Mission School of Ministry. He completed his PhD under Paul Yans and Oliver Davies at King's College London. His first book, The Way of the Kenotic Christ, was a major English monograph on the Christology of Jürgen Moltmann. And he has published on interreligious topics, theology and psychology, the thought of Martin Luther, the old Saxon Heliand, natural theology, narrative pedagogy, kenosis, and the theology of the cross. And so with that introduction, I give you our first lecture in this series, When Doctrine Hurts, Theology in Light of Trauma, with Dr. Sam Youngs.
Things that probably don't motivate a lot of relinquishing of the streaming time would be words like theology, which doesn't get a ton of people out of bed in the morning, and probably not trauma either. I mean, trauma is an incredibly heavy topic. And frankly, we're going to be getting into some heavy things tonight in discussing this subject matter, when doctrine hurts, theology in light of trauma. The idea being that in this kind of two-session series that myself and Dr. Preston Hill are doing over the next 2 weeks here for Theology on Tap, we're going to try to pay attention and come alongside, and you guys come alongside us, paying attention to the ways in which the church can both be a resource for healing and restoration in the midst of traumatization, but also, and much in line with what we're talking about tonight, how the church can sometimes unwittingly, often, but contribute to traumatization in various contexts and in various ways. And so I do want to say, because of the heaviness of the subject matter of trauma, what it means, and we'll say more about what trauma means here in a little bit, but I do want us to, I think it's a good idea to kind of prepare our hearts a little bit. I mean, this is not a church service. We're not going to do anything like overtly, you know, spiritual discipline or something. But I do think it's good to take a beat and to be aware that some of what we're going to talk about tonight by way of examples, by way of real-world application, depending on your background, depending on what you've experienced, we've all been touched by trauma in certain ways, even if it's those we know or something else. I just want us to be aware of that. That's a heavy space. It's kind of a sacred space in a way, the space of survivors, the space of victims. So I just want to say that at the beginning. Like, there's a lot of significant and interesting ideas I think we're going to get into, but over all of that, I think it just needs to be stated, and that beat needs to be taken before we proceed. And so in proceeding, we got a little bit of work to do out of the gate, and I always tell Matt, Theology on Tap is really tough because this is coming out of an article I've written. The article's written for kind of more like, you know, for professors, basically. And so there's like the work I have to do in basically an hour or less is do some preliminary sort of leveling, right? I don't know what everybody knows about this subject matter, but if I just try to plunge headfirst into the argument, you know, you guys, it needs to be contextualized, right? What is this about? Why is he concerned to argue this particular point that he's bringing before us tonight? So, by way of that leveling procedure, we're honestly going to spend probably about 20 minutes just what is theology? What does it mean to do theology the way I'm going to proceed to do it and the way Dr. Hill's going to be doing it in 2 weeks? and then also a bit of what is trauma. And for the clinicians in the room, it will not be an exhaustive course on traumatology, of course, but enough sort of hooks and enough general orientation that even if you've come to this tonight without much of an understanding of the technical meaning of trauma, you'll have enough to then see in the second half of the time what I'm arguing for and why I think it is significant. That's the hope, at least. That's the plan. I've given you my plan. Now you get to see if I follow through with my plan. So the first question is this: What is theology? And theologians, as we are wont to do, tie themselves in all kinds of knots describing what theology is, right? They lots of different kind of definitions about how different things serve the church and form the soul, and how theology is supposed to be liturgical, devotional, homiletical, all these different ideas. On the most basic level, like textbook kind of definition, theology, and here I mean theology in general, not just Christian theology, is the stuff that religious people say about religious topics, okay? When religious people talk about the God they believe in, they talk about the system of salvation they hold to, talk about what they think is wrong with the world or the human condition, when it's a religious person talking about that, about their own beliefs, there's something theological going on. It's words about holy things or words about God, theos and logos. That's where we get the word. So you can have, of course, Islamic theology, Jewish theology, Christian theology. Obviously, tonight, the space we're stepping into is Christian theology, Christian words about God, or Christian words about really all manner of things, sin, salvation. All those things have to do with God, obviously, and so all of it counts as theology. Another word you're going to hear me use quite a bit is doctrine. What we mean by doctrine is kind of an encapsulation of a particular theological teaching, right? So certain doctrines you might have heard about. Some idea about predestination would be a doctrine, right? Some idea about a particular way of rendering the atonement would be a doctrine, right? And so we're going to be using that language fairly freely. I also hold pretty strongly, and not everybody does who practices theology, but I hold pretty strongly to the idea that theology needs to be forward-looking. Right? What do I mean by that? Obviously, theology has to do with an inheritance, something that comes from the past, right? The religion predates the theologian. And so in dealing with that inheritance, the theologian has to decide how are they going to relate that inheritance to the world around them. I take the position that theology is a contextual enterprise. And as a contextual enterprise, it means it always needs to be looking outward and helping the church, helping the religious community that the theologian is a part of, think well about their surroundings, think well about the current cultural issues. It's one reason why I love Theology on Tap. Theology on Tap's governing kind of engine, as Matt described earlier, is to do kind of that theology and culture. What does it look like for Christian thinking, Christian religious affirmations to look out and to take account of what's going on around them and to help the church to be aware of things that matter not just to people inside the church but outside the church as well? And so in thinking about that, I want to draw attention to a book. I'm going to be drawing your attention to several books tonight. You'll get a pretty good reading list along the way if you want to keep track of them. Jen Baldwin's book, Trauma-Sensitive Theology, Thinking Theologically in the Era of Trauma. That subtitle is very much what I'm interested in this conversation, how to think theologically. It's interesting what she says, right? An era of trauma. You could misread that and suspect that she thinks that trauma is new. That's not what she means by it. We're living now in a very trauma-aware cultural moment, right? An awareness of trauma, an attention to trauma. You guys all showed up. If it just said theology, you might not have shown up. But theology and trauma together, you were interested, you were engaged. It's something that's touching the current cultural pulse and the struggles of an awful lot of people. It's in this space, dealing with a religious inheritance and bringing it into dialogue with the contemporary social environment, that I also want to ask this question. What can theology do? This is an important thing to ask about almost any discourse, right? Any way of talking, any way of studying the world. What can it do? What does it do? There's a certain kind of, superficial or shallow view that a lot of us have as we're going about our daily lives where we think the point of a particular way of talking is to convey information. Oh, what does theology do? Oh, he just told us. It conveys like religious information, I guess. Well, that's maybe one thing that it does. But what else does it do? What kind of impact do the things that Christians say about God, what impact does that have on the world? What does it do to people's lives? Who does it give hope to? Who does it terrify? Who does it justify? Who does it hide? These are some of the heavier things we're going to be broaching tonight. Next week, Dr. Hill's going to be speaking to this dimension of theology. Certainly, theology can and does give hope and maybe even open up certain pathways to restoration in the midst of traumatizing circumstances, in the midst of suffering. But tonight, I want to also pay attention to this. Theology can, and I will argue has, contributed to traumatization. That doctrine, things that Christians have said about God and the world and sin and salvation, have in various ways contributed to a degree of pain and suffering, often again unwittingly, often against the intentions of the church. And so that there in red is very much what we are pursuing tonight. And so in many ways, like I said earlier, it's a heavy topic. I mean, this is meant to sort of be a reflective, analytical sort of pull apart and look inside, and some of the looking inside will yield a degree of messiness and probably a degree of discomfort. So thank you all for diving into that space with me as we think about this together. One thing I want to do pretty quick is distinguish what we're doing tonight from this. So Marlene Winnell, about 10, 12 years ago, clinical psychologist, she put out the definition of something called religious trauma syndrome. Has anybody heard about this, religious trauma syndrome? A few people in the room. Religious trauma syndrome, hearing what I've said so far, if you're familiar with this at all, you might think that this is what I'm about to talk about. And I'm really showing it to you by way of saying, although this is very important to pay attention to, it's not what we're talking about tonight. Religious trauma syndrome, according to Winnell, is the condition experienced by people who are struggling with leaving an authoritarian, dogmatic religion and coping with the damage of indoctrination. Through the shattering of a personally meaningful faith and or breaking away from a controlling community and lifestyle. This is vitally important. Some of you in this room might be going through this or something like it. You might know people who have gone through it. Just paying a little bit of attention to social media will show you people going through some variety of this. There's a moment and an experience that this touches very acutely. But this is very much about authority and community and lack of autonomy and constrictiveness, all of which are really vital issues, but those are more about the structures of religion. And in fact, they're the kind of structures that can be applied to almost any supervening kind of communal identity, religious or not. What we're talking about tonight is much more religiously specific. We're talking about the actual content of Christian beliefs, the actual statements of Christian theological beliefs. So, important, study it, pay attention to it, but it's a little different than what we're engaging tonight. All right, so further, by way of preamble, let's talk a little bit about what trauma is and what we mean by the word trauma. I'll say maybe more than once tonight, I do stand pretty firmly against and try to highlight it when I can, the unfortunate kind of colloquializing of the word trauma, where people are like, oh, it took me forever to get my food, it was traumatic, you know, that kind of expression. And this happens with language. Like, I don't want to be like on a soapbox about it. You know, language that's about serious things eventually becomes colloquial and applied to non-serious things. It's probably some level of like linguistic adaption or coping to some of the more difficult things in life. I mean, you know, killing isn't all that light of a thing, but you know, we'll hear a good joke and say, "Oh, it killed me," right? I mean, so this happens with language. But I do think the particular moment we're in, again, Jen Baldwin, an era of trauma, we all would do well, I think, to pay attention to how we use the word, because it has a very specific meaning, a very specific empirical and clinical meaning, and that's the meaning we want to talk about for a few minutes here. Again, it can't be exhaustive due to our time constraints. I usually talk about trauma from three angles: biology, psychology, culture, in that order. So that's what we're going to do in short order here. Trauma is first and foremost biological. It's a bodily thing. It happens at the level of the body's and the brain's reactivity to certain events, right? Certain dangerous events, certain violent events, certain terrifying events. Your body is remarkable. Our bodies have been designed by God to have incredible responses that can be life-saving when we are in danger, right? The fight or flight or freeze reflex, right? Something like this, something where the body, if the conditions are such that it can react and it can know, unconsciously, subconsciously, you go into motion, you do things, your body propels you. Surges of stress hormones that give you maybe incredible reaction time, maybe even strength, depending on the circumstances. That's really incredible that the body can do that, and it saves a lot of people's lives, right? Those kinds of responses. But in trauma, Shelley Rambo, who's a theologian and who engages trauma as well, she says it this way. She says, in traumatic response, there is a breakdown of multiple systems that we rely on to protect us from harm. These are good things, things that protect us, things that ought to be a part of us, that basically get stuck, right? The feeling of the danger, the memory, the terror. There's a variety of chemical and even physical things that we could talk about why this happens. Maybe we can explore that more in Q&A if people want to. But essentially, there's a stuckness to trauma, that the past does not become truly the past, that the terrifying event or the violent event becomes almost stuck to the person's identity, and it doesn't get integrated. That's the language for it. A moment that brings about extreme suffering or fear is often integrated into our conscious experience, and we can move through it. But when some things, especially when things are truly, and this is key language across the literature on trauma, when things are overwhelming, when they bring us totally past the point of our ability to control outcomes, the ability to be seen by a witnessing community, the ability to put the overwhelming or violent event into a larger system of meaning, that is when traumatization can occur, when it overwhelms. And unless pretty decided action is taken, it can stay stuck. What does it look like for it to be stuck? It looks like flashbacks, right? Something that is in the past, but it's not really in the past. It becomes part of present perception, often beyond a person's control. It can look like dissociation, depression, anxiety. It can look like diagnosed PTSD. All of these things, the biology of trauma is very important to recognize. There's also psychological correlates. I mentioned these very quickly a moment ago. A really tremendous book, if you have interest in the subject area, is Judith Herman's Trauma and Recovery. And in that book, she really explores so many dimensions of the psychology and psychiatry of trauma. But the point I want to raise from Herman is kind of this threefold dimensionality of the psychology of trauma. Again, not all suffering is traumatic, but if any one of these three things is taken away, is overwhelmed by the experience, especially if two of the three or even all three are taken away, that's the open door to traumatization, to that stuck experience of suffering that does not get integrated. Loss of control, loss of community, loss of meaning. And there's her work, Trauma and Recovery. So again, to make this a little more concrete, this is one reason why a situation like domestic abuse can be almost guaranteed to be traumatizing, not just a regular instance of suffering that someone moves through readily, but almost always is traumatic, because especially when it's an abusive situation and the abuse victim is a child, right? Out of the gate, control is gone, right? They're a child. They're in a disproportionate power relationship. Violence is being visited upon the child. The child does not want it. It's a total loss of control. But what about community? Does the child have a witnessing community? Do they have coworkers? Do they have access to a counselor or even to a church community of peers where they can talk through any of this or get help? No. So, I mean, that kind of community, the empathetic or witnessing community that can help with this, is cut off from the child. And then meaning. We want to think especially maybe here about a child who's being ostensibly raised in a religious or even Christian context. Maybe they believe, maybe they've been taught via kind of what they hear around them in a system of life in which their parents love them and wants what's best for them, but their parent is hurting them. So that meaning is highly destabilized and thrown into question. But they've also heard about God, and God loves you, and God will look out for you, and He has plans for you. But where is God when this is happening, right? So on all three levels, this is the kind of experience, dark and heavy experience, that is pretty much guaranteed to be traumatizing. Certainly not the only one. This final point about culture probably isn't getting said enough. I don't know, maybe it is at this point, but I think it really bears some emphasis, and that's why I like to try to talk about it when I talk about trauma. Biology, psychology, and culture. Individual traumas can be acute or chronic. They can also be complex, kind of a mixture of those two things. But an acute trauma is, you know, a singular traumatizing event, big event, could be a terrible car accident or something like that. Or it can be chronic. It can be built up over time. And that's how individuals kind of progress through traumatizing circumstances. But a person doesn't have to go through traumatic suffering to be deeply affected psychologically by trauma. This is called intergenerational trauma. Intergenerational trauma is the idea that if a parent, again, back to parents and kids, if a parent is suffering from various psychiatric symptoms as a result of their trauma. Maybe the parent's like highly anxious, hypervigilant, hasn't integrated a traumatic experience. Well, then that child's gonna be raised with a highly anxious parent, right? And that could look like all sorts of different things. It's the idea that the symptom kind of spreads out, right? It lands, it's almost like a drop of dye in the water. It diffuses throughout kind of the close interpersonal ties of the family or even broader communities. This can happen via the environment that's constituted by those who have come before us or who are older than us. It can also happen epigenetically. We can't say a ton about this, but basically epigenetics is the idea that there's things that impact the genetics that are not themselves a part of the genetic code of a person. So for instance, again, mothers and babies in utero, a mom going through a traumatizing circumstance while she's pregnant, that experience, because the baby shares her physiological symptoms, the child can be affected, like their literal body, their literal physiology can be affected by that in all sorts of ways, all sorts of maladaptive ways. Individual trauma, intergenerational trauma, if enough of that happens on a broad enough scale, in a deep enough pattern, you get what's called either historical or sometimes cultural trauma. The terms seem to be used fairly interchangeably, so I just stuck them together. Historical and cultural trauma. The idea of collective identity and maybe even social structures that have been contaminated, that it has continued to spread out and continued to affect different things. If you're interested in learning more about either of these three dimensions of trauma, this is quick book time. The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, probably the best and certainly most widely read at this point on the biology of trauma. Judith Herman on the psychology of trauma, I've mentioned her already. I want to camp out for a second on this third book by Rezma Menakem, My Grandmother's Hands. Anybody who's aware of this book, My Grandmother's Hands in here? Good, about a quarter of you. Remarkable book. It's been out now for about half a decade, was out ahead of a lot of other books that are now very well known on trauma. Menakem, in that book, hits an incredibly gracious and genuinely therapeutic tone about the nature of what he calls, I don't know if you can see the subtitle, racialized trauma. And racialized trauma for him, he's masterful in the way he cashes this out, but he's obviously trying to address racial injustice and the intersections between racial injustice and traumatization. And he talks about individual traumas and intergenerational traumas and cultural traumas. And as he talks through quite a bit of history and quite a bit of psychology, he makes a couple of really powerful points that I've carried with me for years and that in many ways are generative for our discussion tonight. He talks about the way that beliefs, like this conceptual content about the way the world works and how people relate to one another and how people are valued, that throughout history, those beliefs have had a decided role in shaping the form of traumatization. That certain things, I'm gonna say this slowly and very precisely on purpose because this is where we can get into some water I want to avoid, I want to be very precise, that beliefs can make possible certain social conditions that could not have occurred without the support of those beliefs. Does that make sense? It is incorrect, and we can say more in the Q&A if this point is confusing, I think it is incorrect to say that beliefs equal trauma, no matter what the beliefs are. That's not the way trauma works. That's why I've gone through this rehearsal on kind of these different dimensions of trauma. Trauma is in the body. Trauma is not a concept, right? Trauma is a real and material thing in the world. That means a belief can play a role in traumatization, but something has to happen, right? And I do think it's an unfortunate dimension of maybe some sloppy social discourse right now where people might say, oh, that belief, that's a traumatizing belief, right? That, you know, they make this one-to-one sort of statement. What I think they're actually after when they say that is something like what I'm trying to cash out here. The way that beliefs relate to social circumstances in which certain kinds of traumatization becomes possible. My thinking there's been very shaped by Menakem and his notion of racialized trauma. And I borrow his framing in what follows here. My question became, as I continued to think about this and learn about this, a tremendous catalyst for this kind of study in my own life is my wife, who's sitting right here on the front row. Anna Youngs, my wife, is a trauma therapist, and she and I have the vocational delight of really appreciating what each other does for a living and talking a lot about it. And so lot of my interest, even my awareness of these authors, would not have been there without Anna and the discussions we're constantly having about what she is doing and how she is helping people and the way religion and spirituality relate to it for good and for ill. And as I've been thinking about this and talking with Anna over the past several years, teaching my classes, I became more and more driven by the following question. And this is coming near the end of the preamble, and then we'll actually talk about the thing that you came to talk about tonight. And my question is this: what ideological and institutional role has Christian teaching, that's theology, that's doctrine, has Christian teaching held in the generation and perpetuation of traumatization? How do we think about theology in light of trauma? That's what we're talking about tonight. In this article that I mentioned, which we might refer to a little bit later on as well, I phrased it this way. I said, many of the traumas in Western history are tangled up with theological constructs. Consequently, theologians must be interested in what could be called theologized trauma. There I'm borrowing on Menachem's framing of racialized trauma. This is trauma that at least partially correlates with the social consequences of specific theological or doctrinal constructs. So that's what we are after. That's When Doctrine Hurts, Theology in Light of Trauma. Getting a little more specific about theologized trauma, right? This particular phrasing that I am essentially coining and wanting us to pay attention to that I don't see being discussed very much. Again, a lot of attention in this space is going toward things like RTS, religious trauma syndrome, which is vitally important but a bit different than this. We've already talked about trauma, right? Violence or terror on individual, communal, or cultural levels, especially the kind that, as we noted, gets stuck in the body and perpetuates in various ways. By theologized, I mean this. When a Christian doctrine obscures, these are very precisely chosen verbs, obscures, justifies, or empowers violence or terror on individual, communal, or cultural levels. That's a heavy thing, I think, to peer into. It's a significant thing. And in many ways, what we're going to do in the remainder of our time, I've kind of given you the grammar of it, right? The thing I'm trying to claim about how beliefs against the best intentions, against anything that maybe is wittingly even thought of when a belief is put out there or systematized in a certain way. I've given you kind of the grammar, the logic of what I'm talking about, but it will still seem pretty conceptual if we don't talk about examples, and that'll be the heavy thing in many ways that we have to talk about. What are different examples? What are things that we could point to that I can illustrate to you from history that exemplify some of this relationship? All of this, I should say, is in service of the church. I know a lot of what I'm saying here probably sounds pretty darn critical of the church. But the point of it is, there's more about this that I'll say at the end, but on the most basic level, this is meant to be an exercise in awareness raising. Right, like being attentive, paying attention to a thing that maybe for way too long we haven't paid much attention to the detriment of a lot of people, right? And so it's that kind of calling to account, not to critique, not to debunk, not to say, everybody get out of the church, it's a broken place that wounds people, but to say, it is a broken place that wounds people, and if we're going to stick around, we need to be aware of that. We need to be able to do work in the midst of that. That's how we are. That's how we're proceeding. So the central exploration from what we're going to do in the remainder of our time is theologized trauma. Oh, and I'm right on time. That is rare. Okay, good. Wow. My students in the room know how rare that is. They're like, wow, he's on time. It's ridiculous. Okay, so theologized trauma. I put it up there in Pepto-Bismol colors just because it's so serious. It didn't lighten it up maybe a little bit. We're going to look at three examples. I don't expect you to be able to put much meat on the bones of these examples at first. We're going to keep coming back to this slide over and over again. We'll look at three examples. Remember, I gave you three verbs: doctrine obscures, or justifies, or empowers. Okay, those are going to be how we frame up the three examples we're going to explore. First, we're going to look at an example going back into the 1400s in particular, looking at ways in which certain doctrinal beliefs about demons, yes, demons, were used to obscure various dimensions of truth around sexual assault. And of course, sexual assault is a deep source of trauma on many fronts. Anthropology, that's Christian view of the human being. What is a human being? What is the image of God, right? Christian anthropology, justifying chattel slavery. That's one example chosen, obviously is fitting here in ways that you'll see when we talk about it, but also given what we've experienced, I think, culturally in terms of racial justice conversations over the past several years, that one probably will not need a ton of explanation from me, or at least for a lot of you, I don't think it will. It'll be one of the more obvious ones. And finally, that's a big word there at the start, hamartiology, the study of sin. All right, that's the theology word, the study of sin. And so how does hamartiology work to empower, or how has it worked in certain communities, right? Certain Christian communities, sadly, to empower the maltreatment of children, right? We might even say the abuse of children. Okay. So our first example, demonology obscuring sexual assault. You guys have probably seen kind of creepy pictures like this before. It's a pretty typical portrayal from about the late 1400s onward, often with a woman, often kind of laying prone asleep with like a demon sitting on her. This painting, when it appears, is often referred to simply as the nightmare. What does this have to do? What's being said here? This is actually providing a pictographic interpretation of an experience that a lot of women bore witness to throughout the Middle Ages. Some men too, but usually women. Of waking up in the middle of the night with a crushing presence, a physical presence, essentially assaulting them in the middle of the night. And they can't breathe. They can't escape what's happening. And this is the era, right? We're talking late Middle Ages here, 1300s, 1400s. This is not the era of electric lights, like roll out of bed and turn on your light and figure out what's going on. This is like a deep darkness, middle of the night kind of terrifying thing. And there was this idea that, well, it's a demon. A demon is doing this. It's a demon that gives you nightmares, a demon that makes you feel this way. And this is something that we find across the literature on this subject matter in this time period. Well, the church has to deal with the fact that sometimes women would have these experiences, and shortly thereafter, they would be found to be pregnant. Okay. Shortly thereafter, having been found pregnant, they don't know as much about biology back then as we do today, but they knew enough to know, well, a child has to come from some kind of sexual encounter, right? And sometimes these women are nuns, right? Men do not have easy access to them unless the men are clerical, unless the men are clergy. Sometimes the child would be carried to term and born, and as the child matured, it would look an awful lot like a known monk or a known priest. Again, they don't know what we know about biology, but they know enough. And this, and you might not have ever heard any of what I'm about to tell you. Some of the other stuff we're about to talk about, you've maybe heard pieces of at different times. A functioning belief in the 1400s is that demons had a way of taking semen from men and putting it into women. And that's why the baby looked like a man. In witch hunting and demonological works of the 1400s, they would ask this question. Can children be generated by demons? Because they have to explain this. They have to explain the thing that's happening, right? You and I'm talking through it. You probably think it's pretty obvious. Somebody is sexually assaulting somebody else. But instead, in the literature that's approved at the highest levels of the church for thinking about demons and the devil and witches and all sorts of other things, here's what was said. Devils take their part in this generation, not as the essential cause, but as a secondary cause, since they busy themselves by interfering with the process of normal copulation and conception, obtaining human semen and themselves transferring it. When I say Christian beliefs are put in motion to obscure trauma, this is the sort of thing I'm talking about. This is a more obvious example, like when it's cashed out for you. Maybe you've never heard of it before. It's probably striking you as very weird, very unsettling. The idea that this is not some fringe group or a cult somewhere that had this belief. This was mainstream, widely publicized. This is a thing that can happen. Right? And so this kind of relationship, this particular thing is written in 1486. I mean, it's around, you know, a little bit before Martin Luther was born, right? To give you some scaling, some context. And so that relationship, the way in which doctrine can be marshaled to obscure something, to obscure traumatization, and thus make it hard to address, hard to witness to, difficult to know what to do with moral culpability. Every time I study this particular instance of history, the whole thing is pretty heartbreaking, obviously, but It's also very heartbreaking that often the woman in this alleged scenario with the demon and everything else was found to be morally culpable for this happening to her, because there was some weakness in her heart, gave the devil a doorway to do something to her. There wasn't similar reasoning provided for the man who had his semen stolen by the demon, just for the woman in this case. Anthropology justifying chattel slavery. So I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb when I say this. I'm not an ethicist per se. I deal with theological ethics as it emerges into my fields of study. We have had ethicists before at Theology on Tap, certainly. But I don't think it's too far afield to say that the area of doctrine that is like most charged up ethically is what you say about who gets to count as a human being. Like, who gets to count? What's the criteria? Anthropology can be this centrifuge for incredible justice. It can be an engine for incredible justice, but also the inverse, incredible injustice. And when we say anthropology, that is what we're talking about. We're talking about what gets defined as a human being, what gets defined as humanity, right? When Christians have this discussion, it's almost always a conversation about what we call the Imago Dei, or the image of God, right? What does that mean? What does that consist in? Because Genesis, 1, first chapter of the Bible, where image of God is first used, does not do the incredibly convenient thing that we so wish the Bible would do, but it never does, which is just define this for us. That would be so convenient. By image of God, I mean this, right? Give us a sentence or two. And so theologians have puzzled year over year still to this day. What is meant specifically by image of God? Well, it means we're like God in some way. Yeah, okay, but in what way? God's pretty big. There's lots of ways in which we could be like God. What does it mean? What does it mean to be like God? A very popular answer championed by some of the greatest thinkers in church history is that it's our reason. Capital R reason, our rationality. Thomas Aquinas, who I'm not picking on here at all, he's just iterating a tradition that predates him in many ways. Thomas Aquinas says, while in all creatures there is some likeness to God, in the rational creature alone we find a likeness of image. The rational creature gets the image. Image of God means rational. The intellect or mind is that whereby the rational creature excels other creatures. Why is anthropology so charged up ethically? In Christianity, using Christianity as our space to talk about here, whatever you say the image of God is, whatever that is, people have control over that. They get to say what that is, what counts for that. Rationality, have people always agreed on what's rational? On what constitutes a reasonable person, a reasonable way of looking at the world? I don't have to argue pretty far, I don't think, for you guys to realize that rationality is very culturally conditioned. And thus, if you can mess with what goes in the rationality basket, what have you messed with? The image of God basket. And if you mess with it enough, you can exclude certain people, right? And you can exclude them then from the image of God. We sometimes use the word dehumanize somewhat loosely. That's literally what this would be, right? To be evacuating the humanity out of another group of people, right? And so Thomas Aquinas doesn't make much of a move past this on this point, but because he defined, and many others defined, the image of God with reason, when white Europeans decided that certain elements of white civilization were going to count as rational, gosh, that's a hugely important move. I mean, it shapes hundreds of years of history. The certain kind of civilization will be deemed the most rational, the purest, the highest, the most conceptually robust. What does that mean about everybody else? Especially the ones you can make the most money on if they're conscripted in an economic form of chattel slavery, right? And this is what happens. And it would exhaust you, and it would exhaust me. It does exhaust me to study it. The number of times Christians comment on the Atlantic slave trade on this basis, making a distinction between themselves and people from Africa, and saying, they are not us. They are not human. We can do this because of the way we've set the terms, the way we've staged the encounter in history. I'll give you one example, and this one's very moving to me. A lot of these are moving, but this one has quite a blend of humanity to it. 1444 is pretty much the very beginning of the Portuguese slave trade. There's a chronicler, a historian essentially at the time, Gomes Zurara, And Gomez Zurara has given us, we still have it to this day, a chronicle of him bearing witness to enslaved families being, separated. Some going this way, some going that way. And as he's bearing witness to this, he sees how sad this is and how much the mothers are calling out for children and everything else. And he finds, as this Western European Christian chronicler of this event, who's on board, he's on board with what's happening, he's conscripted in this cultural moment, he feels an incredible burden for them. His heart is kind of reeling from what he sees, and he can't make sense of it, and he happened to write this down for us. It's really fascinating. Willie James Jennings' book, The Christian Imagination, which is probably one of the very best books on the history of the Christian construction of racism, has this story. It's where I first encountered it. In his chronicle, this is what Zurara writes, 1444, "If these brute animals with their bestial feelings can instinctively understand their own suffering, what would you have," he's talking to God, "what would you have my human nature do on seeing before my eyes that miserable company?" It's another one of those moments where I feel like a beat or kind of a moment of silence kind of has to be observed, because so much is bottled up in that, right? So much suffering, so much human-on-human violence and exploitation. And it is this incredibly human moment where this chronicler says, he can't make sense of it. He doesn't know why his heart is moved, because you can see in his language, he's been theologically trained to say they are not human. That's what he's struggling with. He's struggling really against his spirituality and his theology. He's struggling against his moral heart and the doctrine he's been given, right? A doctrine that served to justify chattel slavery and obviously leave to one of the most sizable collective traumatizations of a people group that we ever have known about in human history, right? And so that's this example, anthropology justifying chattel slavery. Take a moment, take a deep breath maybe, exhale. These are heavy topics, I know. Preston's will be far more hopeful next week on a lot of levels. It was important that we pay attention to this. And notice that these are all very different relationships. Well, just kind of, and this is not like a back and forth classroom, I guess, but just nod if you're tracking with me so far, okay? We'll have back and forth in the Q&A, obviously. These first two, both incredibly awful things, but doctrine is doing something different there, right? The stuff in yellow is different. It's a different relationship. This final one is also a bit different. In general, the relationship of justification, the second one there, it's theology that's kind of coming alongside a practice that already exists and like kind of tries to make it okay. Not to put like a too fine of a point on it, but Christians benefited an awful lot economically from something like chattel slavery. Just read any of the antebellum defenses of slavery from the southern states from Christian ministers, and they will almost always be talking about the economic dimensions of it. Right, Ben Palmer's Thanksgiving sermon is a really well-known example. And so we had to be aware of that, a justifying relationship, something that's already afoot in the world, maybe quite probably conveying material or economic benefit, and theology can come along and justify. Doctrine can come along and say that thing that might be traumatizing some group or another, that can be made okay if we just reason this way about it theologically. These are all limited groups. I said that already, I think, but I'll say it again. Nothing I'm intending to say here is all Christians obscured sexual assault or all Christians justified chattel slavery. Certainly on this next one, not all Christians have empowered child maltreatment, right? These are different ways in which various communities, various times in history, that doctrine has done this kind of work, depending on circumstances and conditions. Hamartiology is the doctrine of sin. A lot of what we think about sin in the West, Catholic and Protestant, is somehow hooked back up in the 400s to Augustine of Hippo. Probably the most significant theologian of, especially, like I said, the Western traditions. Somebody, I'm forgetting who, said all of Western theology is footnotes to Augustine. Not that everybody agrees with Augustine on everything, but that he sets the terms, he sets the stage, he's gone to the places and set out the categories in a way that hadn't been done quite as robustly before. All that to say, what this guy said about stuff really mattered and still matters down to the present day. Anybody in here ever read Confessions by Augustine? A few of you? Yeah. Confessions, I feel like that's one that still gets assigned like as part of a classical education retinue if you did classical education in high school. Confessions is very famous, one of the most famous literary or theological works of the Western tradition. And it's easy to forget about this part of Confessions I'm about to put up because the rest of it, it just soars. And so this is book one, like page 7 of book one I'm about to show you. So it's very early in Confessions. Confessions is long. Every time I have my students read it, they're like, this is long. I say, yeah, you still gotta read it. Through his conversion experience, all his beautiful reflections on God and time and the Trinity, there's so much incredible stuff in the Confessions. It's very easy to forget about books 1 and 2 and 3. But in book 1, Augustine kind of goes on this moment where he ties together a very deep perception of inherent corruption, inherent moral corruption, with babies. He knits those two things together very tightly. I'll just give you his words here. He says, "Who reminds me of the sin of my infancy? For none is pure from sin before you, not even an infant one day upon the earth." He's quoting from Job. "Who reminds me, any tiny child? At the time of my infancy, I must have acted reprehensibly. The feebleness of infants' limbs is innocent, but not the infant's mind." Really powerful sentence there. I'm going to pause on for a second. The feebleness is innocent, but not the mind. What's he saying? He's basically saying, well, the limbs can't do much damage. The limbs are not guilty of much. The limbs can't kill people. The fact that they're weak is kind of their only saving grace because their mind is corrupted. Their mind is not innocent. If it's not innocent, then what is the mind of the infant? It is guilty, right? He then goes on to tell an anecdote. "I have personally watched a jealous baby. He could not speak, yet pale with jealousy and bitterness, he glared at his brother as his brother shared his mother's milk." Yeah. Yeah. An anecdote. You're supposed to put those in sermons, right? So that's what he does. So what always strikes me about this passage of the Confessions is he doesn't just do hamartiology. He says also, like, I'm kind of doing science, he says. Like, I'm observing my world. And when I observe my world, what do I see? Do I see, like, a hungry baby? Or no, I see a jealous, bitter baby. That's what I see. Yeah, that's what is seen. And so the legacy of this, the child, if you're jealous and you're bitter and you're sinful, you're not innocent, so you're guilty. If you're reprehensible, that's all here. Where does the baby stand in relation to God? What is the baby in the eyes of God? What does God think about reprehensible sinfulness? Who holds the baby to be reprehensible? Who's Augustine speaking for there? If God somehow finds the baby reprehensible, then what is the duty of the Christian parent? What is the duty? What is to be done? Because you have a scenario in front of you, right? You have a baby who from day one, according to Augustine, is somehow bad, right? Bad, opposed to God in certain ways, right? Obviously, various Christian communities have done different things with this, but some Christian communities have taken it as license for very extreme corporal punishment of children. And I emphasize very extreme. But why? This is something you got to ask yourself. Like when you study like the history of chattel slavery and Christianity, which we've already talked about, it's good to have the moral, the moral cylinders all functioning. You should ask. You should push the book or the video or whatever away for you and say, how? How could that happen? How could Christians do that? How could that be taking place? You read about some of these ostensibly Christian communities, some of which are alive today, one of which was just busted last year, where on Christian grounds, under Christian theological pronouncements, children are treated a certain way. It's not that what Augustine says here has to lead to that. That's never the point that's being made here. Remember what I said, it's not one-to-one, right? Of course, you can have a view of something like original sin, which is related to what Augustine's saying here, and not treat children badly. But in cases where Christians have done it, this doctrine is used to empower it. That's the relationship we're paying attention to. Phil Graven writes a book called Spare the Child, The Religious Roots of Punishment and the Psychological Impact of Physical Abuse. Some dimensions of our talk tonight are hard. This book is one of the hardest things I've ever read. It is really hard. He's a material historian, which means most of this book is diary entries. And most of it focuses on the Puritans and how the Puritan inheritance affected an awful lot of things about, frankly, the way certain communities in America still think child discipline should be handled. So here's a quote. This is from Graven's book. John Robinson, 1600s. He says, you can hear the echoes of Augustine here, there is in all children a stubbornness arising from natural pride, pride by nature, born with that, right? That's what that means. This fruit of corruption and root of rebellion against God must be destroyed. That's the conclusion. That this is an implication for parental duty in the eyes of God, right? It must be destroyed. For the beating, parents must provide carefully that children's wills be repressed. Children should not know, if it could be kept from them, that they have a will of their own. Remember what I said earlier about agency and trauma. The loss of control, the loss of agency is the first thing in defining a traumatic experience from an instance of integrated suffering. Other books have explored this. Again, if it's something that you want to explore further and learn more about, Janet Heimlich's book, Breaking Their Will, that kind of phrasing obviously derives from things that are said here by John Robinson, the idea that the will of the child needs to be broken, or what does he say? Destroyed, in order for some kind of, for a kind of a holy work or a sanctifying work to take place. I was not raised with a lot of this kind of thing, but there might be people in the room today who have some of this as a dimension of a Christian upbringing. I don't know. And it's a if this resonates at all with you, it could be illustrative of what we're trying to convey in some of these relationships. So what is theologized trauma? What am I asking us to try to pay attention to? When doctrine functions to obscure or justify or empower traumatizing circumstances, I want to emphasize again, because it's a lot of heavy stuff, that at no point am I trying to say that a particular Christian view of the supernatural, like demons, or a particular view of anthropology, or a particular view of sin necessarily leads to these things happening. But I feel like we sometimes get in a position in the church where we say that and then we just leave it. Oh, it's not one-to-one. Okay, it doesn't cause it. It could not happen that way. So we're like, what, off the hook? Like, don't have to pay attention, don't have to be aware, don't have to attend to it, don't need to be humble about it. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. What I do think it means, more so than anything positive, is it means something negative. It means that this can be scary. It means that this is a scary thing to pay attention to. A lot of this stuff is bothersome to look at. When I talk about it tonight, or sometimes just when I'm reading or writing about it, I can feel it in my body. Pay attention to our bodies if we're trying to be trauma-informed. I feel a tension in my chest, a constriction, because this kind of thing is so affecting, and to some degree for myself as a Christian, is a scary thing to acknowledge about history and about how doctrine can relate to the world. My project here is not totally without any kind of precedent, of course. I'm drawing on, as you've seen, a number of different thinkers. A book, I told you I'd give you a reading list, a book that's not as well known as it should be, even though Lauren Winter is very well known. If you've heard of Lauren Winter, you probably haven't heard of this book, The Dangers of Christian Practice. In this book, Winter essentially sets out to talk about Christian practices. What does she mean by Christian practices? Communion, baptism, prayer, like activities, Christian activities that Christians do. She essentially sets out to make a case similar to what I've made here about doctrine. So to illustrate how kind of a piece, and she puts some really good language to this that I want to borrow. So I'll show you something she says in her introduction. She says, drawing on a Christian doctrine of fallen human condition, right? Creatures are damaged, and creatures with agency perpetuate damage in many different ways. She says, I read Christian practices like the Eucharist and prayer under the pressure of understanding of this understanding of sin and damage, with the aim of encouraging the church to be what? To be on the lookout. It's a lot of what this is tonight. To be on the lookout for the ways that good Christian practices may and inevitably sometimes will do the very opposite of what those practices were made to do. So you could go through here. I had this on another slide, but I thought it was cheesy, where I took the word practice out every time and put the word doctrine in, but you can do that yourself. That's essentially a statement that I'm trying to render for us. To be on the lookout, on some level wanting to say that theology is a thing the church does, and so if the church is made up of broken people, there'll be a brokenness to theology, and broken things hurt people sometimes. At the heart of it, the thesis is not much more complicated than that. It's just a matter of attending to it with our eyes wide open. The value of attending to theologized trauma. This is the last slide here. What are the values? I perceive at least four. In Q&A, you might see others, or you might end up disagreeing with these four and saying, I don't see this value. But the four that have come to me as I've thought about this and thought about presenting it to you all is that on one level, this is the one we've talked about the most already, just an awareness of the damage, right? It's hard to know how to help. It's hard to know how to be present. It's hard to know how to speak or address things that we're unaware of, that we haven't studied adequately, that we haven't looked at fully. Humility in our proclamation. I was talking to a member of pastoral staff here at the mission earlier in the week, and I gave him, he couldn't be here tonight, so I gave him kind of the cliff notes of this talk, and he sort of sat back in his chair, and he said, like, what, so should we just not do theology? Should we just not do this? He was feeling pretty overwhelmed by some of, like, the damage I'm discussing here. And he's like, it just seems so, like, you know, he was just caught by the weight of it. And I don't think that's the necessary conclusion, certainly, but I do think a really important implication is that in the proclamation of the faith, which often involves theological claims, that there's a humility that's not, I'm not trying to be too snarky when I say this, that's not just kind of a check-the-box humility. I think we can distinguish the difference. Check the box humility. You say a couple words at the beginning of the proclamation to make sure everybody knows how humble you are about it. But really actually be humble in your proclamation, right? Humble in how it is applied, humble in how it's rendered over and against other ways of viewing God in the world. Humble in the sense that you might say, as a speaker who dares the immense thing of saying words about God, to say, I don't have all the answers here, and what I'm saying here might not be the most helpful way of saying it, right? So humility in proclamation. Understanding for survivors and victims as well. Obviously, not everyone who suffers trauma survives it, right? So understanding for survivors and victims, knowing more about what led to the circumstances in which their traumatization could occur. This last one is maybe controversial. I hope not. The one who I think about in this talk and in this context is Zurara, right, the Portuguese chronicler, who's caught up in a theologically defined event, right, in which humans are doing things to non-humans, according to what he's witnessing. And he's inherited that. But he's going to chronicle it. He's not going to stop it. To a degree, he is perpetuating it. And yet, we can have extreme empathy for how he's come to inherit such a broken situation, right? But I think we would be deficient in our empathy if we didn't understand that it's theological, not just material, not just social, right? And so being robust in our awareness, our humility, our understanding, and our empathy, I feel like these are values. These are hard-won values because this kind of study is difficult. It's a hard thesis to attend to. We want to look away from it, I think. But I think it's got these values to it. And so I'll encourage us all to pay attention, right? To pay attention to the way that what we say about God in the world, the way it lands on people's lives, the way it lands on people's bodies, and how right now we could be participating in things that we've inherited and have not yet truly begun to step back from and analyze. It's hard work, but I think it's work that is worth it. And I thank you guys for being here tonight. Thanks.